Cambridge Muslim College, training the next generation of Muslim thinkers.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala rasulillah, wa alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. It's a rather subtle, difficult, often unsatisfying kind of subject, not least because it's one of those sort of issues where Muslims get kind of agitated and jumpy very quickly. It'd be interesting to actually make a list of those subjects where somebody only has to press a button and everybody starts jumping up and down saying halal or haram or whatever. Hijab issues, gender interaction issues are a famous one, and this seems to be another for whatever reason, even though it's kind of historically and Quranically on the sort of outer edge really of what is actually explicitly treated, and also surrounded by a good deal of classical discussions that were not resolved in the classical period and are unlikely to be resolved by our lesser selves. But if we're looking more generally at the question of sound, there are certain things that we can say where we can perhaps make some progress without getting into the minutiae of the fiqh. Sound is the sense whereby revelation first reaches us. The Qur'an is a book, a kitab, but the iqra was about that one of the five senses that is to do with the ears. It's oral and the production of a sound which is only perceived by people who can hear. That is the modality of communication, human subjects engaging with each other in creation, which has been chosen preferentially to be the level on which the elemental principle of the divine speech operates. Revelation as a heard text. That means that we are dealing with a human faculty which is to do with hearing depth and engaging even with the infinite, because when we hear the divine speech, we are hearing something that is freighted with all of these theological paradoxes about the uncreated antiquity of the word. Ayatu haqqin min ar-Rahmani muhdathatun qadimatun sifatul mawsufi bil qidami. It's verses from the merciful which are renewed but which are ancient, whose ancientness is the quality of he who is ancient. So when we hear the sound and the letters and the cadences and the syncopations of the book, what we are hearing is something that predates hearing itself. So already there is something about this that is mysterious, paradoxical, hard to figure out, but whose impact is profound. And music, using the word in the largest sense, anything beautiful that we like to hear, partakes of that. Scientists argue about it, psychologists argue about it. It's not just the fuqaha. Everybody is not sure what is going on here. Why is it that when human beings, not really very much animals or anything else as far as we can tell, but human beings listen to certain types of sounds, certain measurable neurological and physiological and behavioral consequences tend to occur? When we listen to other kinds of sounds, we get other sorts of responses that are often their opposite. What is it about sounds that can have this profound effect on us, that affect us more immediately than, say, seeing certain things or touching certain things? Sound is something that the ear is a deep part of us. What is happening here? And the neuroscientists have tried hard to figure this out. The octave, for instance, it's a kind of mystery, and they think they may have understood it, but perhaps they don't. Why is it that when you have middle C and then you go up to the C above it, every culture in the world recognizes that those two notes are different but the same? So if you go up to the D, people are less happy. It's not an octave, something else is happening. Why is that? What's the nature of the octave? Why should the human brain, the human ear, be attuned to that as such a fundamental, basic thing in Chinese music, Indian music, Islamic music, Western music? It's something that's in us. It's not just a product of culture. Why should that be? Answer, not sure, but they're doing some interesting work. And now with various sophisticated electric resonance scanners and so forth, they can see things happening in the brain when certain sorts of sounds are produced. And we don't quite know how that works, just as we don't quite know why a certain cadence is considered to be harmonic, whereas other cadences are not. So if you have the first and the third and the fifth note of an octave, of a major octave, it makes a nice harmony. If you have, say, the first and a minor third and then a fifth, it becomes something that can shock us. And a lot of modern music is exploiting that because it's interested in us exploring why we are shocked by certain particular sounds. It's not a very pleasant experience to listen to a lot of it, but it is challenging us to think about why we have this assumption about the nature of beauty and certain symmetries. And the study of that goes back almost as far as the study of anything. The ancient Greeks were very interested in music. They had musical instruments, they had voices. Greek drama, which was their principal cultural production, was essentially like an operatic performance with lots of choruses, and it was musical, and we have an awareness of some of the modes that they used, the Dorian mode, the Mixolydian mode, some of which have their cognates moving on into the modes of Islamic music. And even Plato and others were thinking about Pythagoras. Why is it that some of these modes have a particular effect on us? And of course they couldn't really work it out, but in ancient times, particularly Pythagoras, thought that it was because within us there is the capacity to resonate with things that are intrinsic in the universe, that are part of the mathematics and the geometry of the universe. So the idea that the celestial spheres actually make a particular sound or hit a particular note as they glide along, the music of the spheres, something that came into medieval Christian theology as well very often. Plato was sure of this. So the idea that harmony and our resonance with certain intervals, certain possibilities, is best explained in terms of it resonating with the musical instrument that is creation itself, is something that has a very long history. And that goes into the Islamic discussions with Al-Farabi and his great book of music, and is developed. So it's something human beings have always been interested in, and we still can't quite explain it. But still, it has such a significant impact that music therapy is now a big thing that you can get on the NHS, and all the major hospitals will offer things for a wide range of complaints. If you look at any big medical website and you look up music therapy, you'll see that almost everything is covered by forms of music therapy which are known to have positive clinical outcomes. Otherwise, the NHS wouldn't pay for it if it was useless. Just somebody listening to music, they're not going to pay for that. It has a clinical outcome. And we all think, well, it's probably mental illnesses. That is true because certain forms of schizophrenia are routinely treated with music therapy now. Sometimes forms of chronic depression are treated with music. The major hospitals will have people who work through people with music instruments, rhythms sometimes. We don't quite know why it works, but we can see that it does work. And a lot of mental health care actually uses therapies whose actual mode of operation is not really understood, but since it works, we go with it, because the brain consciousness is such a subtle, difficult thing. We're really in the infancy of neuroscience still. So mental health issues, for sure, demonstrably. Certain types of music release endorphins in the brain, reduce anxieties, give people a sense of serenity. Everybody knows that certain types of music, certain harmonies, help us to chill. Who doesn't know that? And in certain focused scientific ways, this is effective in treating certain forms of mental illness. Obsessive compulsive disorder sometimes can be usefully treated with music therapy. Certain allergies even. Also, heart disease. It's been shown that the pulse is regularized by music, and that also the blood pressure is lowered amongst people who are listening to music. why, exactly how, wherefore, again, the scientists aren't there yet, but it's so demonstrable in clinical trials that it is regularly used. So we know this, and Islamic civilization has already known that for a very long time. If you've ever been to, for instance, the town of Edirne in Turkey, which was the big hadith city of the Ottoman Empire, great ulama there, near the Darul Hadith, there's also the hospital for treating mental patients with music therapy. And they've turned it into a nice kind of museum now, and you can see they have these rather sort of awkward-looking waxworks and Turkish outfits and droopy moustaches, and it's not terribly well done, but you get a sense of how the building was used. The patient would be brought out by the physician, and the symptoms would be read out, and the musicians would play something that was believed to be beneficial. And there's a famous one in Damascus, and it's part of classical Islamic civilization. And that still is alive. You can go to Istanbul and you can buy CDs of music that is used in the treatment of mental disorders. It's still a living tradition. And the Turks have other things to do with rhythms as well, and to do with the beat of a horse's hooves, which is a very ancient therapy that they have from pre-Islamic times, that they believe that somebody with a mental disorder can be helped by the rhythm of riding on a horse of a particular kind. And that, again, is something that is still available in certain corners of Turkey. It's very, Turkey, in a strange way, very modernized, but still has retained a lot of these things quite well. So we have these ancient things that do seem to have some contemporary clinical benefit. And in terms of singing of all of the forms of quote-unquote music or recitation is thought to have particular benefits. So, for instance, forms of asthma are often dealt with by training people's voices in a kind of to sing, because it affects the larynx, it affects the vocal cords, it opens up certain things that may have been twisted or disoriented, speaking very unscientifically here, but by certain modern urban habits, diet, things in the air, dust mites, whatever it might be, that the regular practice of singing actually does seem to have some demonstrable clinical benefit in cases of asthma, and so on. And this is not very surprising, because these are very ancient practices. Singing, some anthropologists, paleontologists will say actually singing is before speech for human beings. Very, very ancient. It's a secular view, of course, but it's the speculation that they offer. It's something elemental. Human beings have always sung. There is no culture ever known amongst human beings where there haven't been traditions of getting together around the campfire and singing together, reciting the heroism of one's ancestors, talking about God or the gods, and collectively celebrating. It's something very antique, and therefore something that's natural to the species, and therefore has positive health outcomes. Nowadays, because of electricity and CDs and iPods and iPlayers and the rest of it, we tend to be passive in our consumption of music. But historically, that was not the case. Historically, people generally were generators of their own music, and this helped to bond families, to bond neighborhoods, to bond church communities, to bond all different religious communities through the human sharing that comes about by jointly making a sound. It's a little bit like sharing a meal together. You're doing something bodily, and as it were, the breaths commingle and everybody has to be on the same page. And it's always been, in Elizabethan England, it was what you did when you went to visit somebody. You would bring along sheet music, and it was specially printed so it could, one sheet of paper for poor people, this was expensive, could be put on a table, and people could read it wherever they were around the table with different parts, and they were really good because they didn't have TVs, they didn't have iTunes passwords, it was just their own music. And because it was what they did, they were often, it's thought, really good. And it was a major form of cultural production, which nowadays we've lost. Most of us don't really like other people listening to us singing. We do it kind of quietly in front of the shaving mirror or something, because we're not good at it, we're not trained. But historically, human communities would sing and would sing well. And very few people are naturally tone deaf. Occasionally, people just can't hit a note. That's maybe 1 in 100 people. usually, if people don't sing well, it's because they've lost a certain knack of listening to others, and the individualism, the self-centeredness of modernity tends to make us less good at listening to subtler things of what's going on in the environment. And the fact there's so many sounds going on simultaneously in the modern world doesn't help either. In a traditional society, there might be a donkey sort of somewhere around the corner, and one's wife might be shrieking at the children. There might be a few recognizable sounds. But the modern city, which is a real cacophony of thousands of cars and sirens and other stuff, is something that seems to be blunting our capacity to recognize pitch. So people nowadays are not so good at singing as they used to. And of course, with the secularization of society, they don't learn the carols, they don't learn the hymns, and we're kind of passive in our consumption of music, partly also because people can make money out of us being passive, whereas if we're generating it ourselves, the kind of capitalistic system isn't quite so good at making money out of that. So there's something about modernity that makes us passive consumers of music rather than active producers of it. So what is fairly evident is that the production of music and of beautiful sounds and singing in particular is as old as human beings, and is also something that's particularly important in religion. I don't think there's a single religion that hasn't cultivated the beauty of sound. The Holy Prophet, alayhi salatu wasalam, said to one of his companions who had a beautiful voice reciting Qur'an, لَقَدْ أُوْتِيْتَ مِزْمَارًا مِنْ مَزَمِيرْ أَلِي دَاوُدٍ. You've been given one of the pipes of David, because according to the biblical text, David played pipes and danced in front of the Ark of the Covenant. That's in their story. But we have this idea of beauty in Qur'anic recitation being important. حَسِّنُوا الْقُرْآنَ بِأَصْوَاتِكُمْ. Make the Qur'an more beautiful through your voices. And this is something that everybody's experienced. If you're in the mosque during Taraweeh, and the imam with a lot of khushu', who knows the maqams and knows the makharij and is sounding beautiful, it's an amazing experience, the most beautiful thing on the planet. But if he's kind of got a smoker's cough and he's kind of always not a semitone off the right note at the end of each verse, you go through, it's completely a different experience. The actual sound, you know, if it was scanned by a computer, might seem very similar, but the human soul can tell that there's a world of difference between a beautiful tajweed and an ugly tajweed, and clearly, the da'wah requires that we present the beauty of the text with beauty. So none of that is particularly controversial. But in Islamic civilization then, the awareness that music is an axiom and the Qur'an is itself musical is not something that anybody's contested. Nobody said, you have to recite the Qur'an in an ugly way. Although sometimes certain Puritans are anxious about certain very elaborate forms of the adhan, for instance. A friend of mine was at the Islamic University in Medina once, and the normal muezzin, he said, of the university mosque had emphysema and a really terrible, cracked, horrible voice. So every time you get this kind of crackling and this nightmare sound would assail your ears. And that went on for years. And then one day that guy was ill, and one of the African students did it instead, and it was beautiful. And the Mufti of Saudi Arabia was there at the time and asked to see this boy and said, don't ever do that again. Don't ever do that again. Because their tradition in Najd is that the azan is, if you listen to Saudi radio from Riyadh, it's Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. That's what they do. And the Maliki tradition also, to be fair, has real reservations about a very ornamented azan. The golden mean is what is required. But in many parts of the Islamic world, you find that the azan is itself an art form, with different maqams being used at different times of day, and they really know their stuff. The traditionally trained Egyptians or Turks or Bosnians, Indonesians, they know this. It's something that maybe hundreds of people are going to hear. And if it really is beautiful and gets into their soul, it's going to make it more likely for them to come to the masjid. It really will. Now, Islamic music, I mentioned that Greek music has the modes, a few basic modes. The Phrygian mode also, we don't know too much about how that worked, although some modern musicologists have reconstructed what ancient Greek music sounded like, pentatonic scale and certain, the lyre that they had, and also a pipe with two pipes, and we can kind of reconstruct what it sounded like. But one of the features of Islamic music, including Tajweed, is the gigantic multiplication of the modes, which become the principal form of aesthetic expression in the oral dimension of Islamic civilization. And everybody had to know the modes. I remember when I was living in Cairo, there were certain great opportunities for the mujawwid, the Qur'an reciter, really to entrance and intoxicate his audience and to make them cry. The really good ones were really good, even though the microphones, oh my God. Just as an aside, the Ministry of Awqaf at the time said, all the mosques have to have microphones and sound systems. What's the cheapest microphone in the world? And they found the system that is used on Russian railways. Right. That's the cheapest, and of course also it sounds the cheapest. So every mosque in Egypt has one of these clunky things. And actually, in those mosques, there's a little button on those things, which I've seen, and if you press the button, it goes ding dong. This is to announce the next train. Right. So that is really a problem, because the azan, which is a beautiful, subtle thing, has been really coarsened and reduced by the poor quality of the sound system. Anyway, a great experience in Cairo, they still do it, is at the tomb of the mosque of Imam Shafi'i, rahmatullahi alayhi, before the khutbah, there is the best, the most popular reciter in Egypt, who is there for about an hour doing his stuff. And because this is for connoisseurs, people go along and they really know what he's doing. And they know the maqams. And it's very interactive. So people say, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Iftah Alayk, at the end of each verse. It's quite noisy. And the reciter can see what's working, what's not working, and which way he's going to go next. And then they'll call out asking for a maqam. So they always begin with maqam sabat. Then if he goes into maqam kurd or maqam nihavan, they'll say, give us some kurd or give us some hijaz. And he'll often respond. And it's a very interactive kind of experience. Because that is the essence of Islamic musical civilization, the maqams. Not so much tune, although it's there. Rhythm is another whole world, which is much more developed in Islamic music than in Western music, because you have strange things like 9 beats in a bar and bars that go on for 31 beats and things that, you know, Mozart would have been driven up the wall by. It's 3/4 time or 4/4 time or common time. It's Western music is rhythmically pretty simple by comparison with what the Turks and the Indians and others were doing. But far more subtle than that is the modal system, which is one of the great achievements of Islamic civilization. Most of the modes which they use were actually derived by Muslims in the medieval period. I remember this guy came to me recently and said, my sheikh says the maqams are haram. Well, the Ottoman Empire for 600 years, nobody ever thought the maqams were haram. And somehow, great, I found something new to make haram. This is the mindset some people have. You know, all those ulama that were listening to, they were wrong, and now it's haram. I said, even the maqams that were composed by ulama, and I gave him some examples, and I don't think he really believed it. He was just kind of trying it out. It was shocking. Nothing, no dalil possibly that could challenge the fact of the maqam system. It's one of the masterpieces, the uncontroversial masterpiece achievements of our civilization. But the maqams, as you well know, are about the intervals between the different pitches in the octave. And whereas in Western music you've got 8 notes in an octave, 12 semitones in an octave, and that's it. That's all that's allowed, except in sort of modern music that does sort of atonal things. If you listen to Stockhausen's sort of modern concerto for a violin and 4 helicopters, for instance, he doesn't stick with the octaves. It's cacophonic stuff that they like nowadays. But Islamic music doesn't use the conventional divisions, equal pitches in an octave, but far more subtle things, because it says between B and B flat, there's something else going on. And it may not even be halfway between the B and the B flat, a quarter tone. So that's part of the artistry of Islamic musical civilization, is that it isn't restricted to the strict rules of 12 quarter tones in the octave, but it has all kinds of complex things, like one maqam where you've got 17 intervals going up and there's 16 coming down, and you really have to listen very carefully or be brought up in one of those civilizations where people just are familiar with that kind of music, really to understand it. And Islamic music is quite difficult for a lot of Westerners really to hear, because they're waiting for the kind of 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the kind of trumpet comes in, and it's a bit simple. Great, Beethoven, great, but still simple compared to the basic assumptions and methods of Islamic music, which is much more subtle and has much more room for improvisation and exploration. That it's hard to get the point of that. If you're not used to a note that's between the B and the B flat, it just sounds like the singer is out of tune. It's a different way of experiencing music. But it's actually common in some of the Celtic fringes, so the traditional Hebridean and Shetland music in England, for instance, they use a lot of quarter tones. Indian music, which historically has interacted a lot with Islamic music, because the great musicians of India, very often they were Muslims, and still the case in many ways. Muslims were the masters in that. But there's indigenous Indic traditions of music that are distinct, but they also are modal. And they have all kinds of rules, like what mode, or what raga do you play, at what time of the year, or for what kind of occasion, or what time of day, because the music and the mode has to be very subtly calibrated to the spiritual atmosphere that prevails with the audience at that particular time. It's a very subtle thing. You can see why it's often used medicinally. And in the Islamic world also, these dozens of maqams, which became really hundreds of maqams, particularly at the hands of the Ottoman Turks, became a whole universe of quite rarefied and often quite difficult, inaccessible elite music sometimes, because most of the maqams are not used for something like tajweed, for instance. Tajweed might use about 15 maqams maximum. So if you go, for instance, to the Fatih Mosque in Istanbul for your Taraweeh, after the Isha, the Salawat and so forth, then the first two rakas will be in a particular maqam. And again, they usually start with maqam Saba. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. It's that interval, everybody knows, that's how it starts. And then after two rakas, there'll be a tasbih or a tamjid, and then another two rakas, and then there'll be an ilahi in a different maqam. There'll be a group of men who are singing in a different maqam, and then the next four rakas of the taraweeh will be in that maqam. And then it will go back usually, not always, I think, usually to maqam Saba according to this traditional progression. But they won't use some of the very rarefied things that were used for Ottoman court music, for sort of private soirees. Those aren't usually used for tajweed. It's not haram, it's just not customary to make people think this sounds a bit new or strange when they really should be concentrating on the sound of the Qur'an. The subtlest question then is, if we know, and the neurologists tell us, that music has an effect on the brain waves and an effect on the physiology, and something deep that goes within us, can we look at each maqam and say, this maqam produces this kind of mood, and this maqam suppresses that kind of mood? And historically, the Muslims have said yes. So Farabi, who wrote the first big book of music in our civilization, early Arabic philosopher, famous lutenist as well, the story goes that with his lute, he could make an audience laugh, or he could make an audience cry, just through the going through the maqams. So there is a theory in our civilization that identifies particular maqams with particular moods, which is why some are used at funerals, for instance, and others at weddings, obvious things, but there's more subtle things as well. And what happens on the sort of subtle liminal level when a great practitioner of tajweed or of salawat or mawlid is taking people up through the maqams in a particular order at a particular time of day when it's raining or when it's not raining, or the other things that are affecting the psychic environment of the people, and then taking them back down again. It's probably beyond words, as music is anyway. But those who are in that environment, particularly those who are really familiar with the tradition, for them it's a finer, deeper, more amazing experience than listening to Dame Kiri at the London Coliseum belting out Verdi. It's something that is deep. So we know that we have this amazing civilization in Islam. The question of instrumental music, I didn't really want to get into the sort of the fiqhiyat, and I mentioned that this is a kind of panic button issue for a lot of Muslims. It is the consensus of the four Sunni schools that instrumental music, which they argue over the exact definition of it, is haram. And that's the normal view. But if you start to go looking, if you're interested in minority views, the safest thing in Islam is always to take what seems to be the consensual view. I mean, even Adil Kalbani, really unexpected voice. If you know who Adil Kalbani is, it's this big sort of Saudi preacher, Salafi, who has sometimes unusual and controversial views, and sometimes he's leading the prayer in Mecca, and then sometimes he says something and they find somebody else. He's kind of thinks for himself. He's the one who last year did the famous tweet about ISIS, if you may recall that, even got into the English press, saying, we have to admit that ISIS comes from our own Salafi Aqidah. And that was a huge thing in Saudi Arabia, and people say, oh no, it's got nothing to do with us. But this is what he said, his tweet, and then he went on Saudi television to explain, we generated them. But the other controversy he's got himself involved with is about 6 years ago, when he really went in a kind of Zahiri tooth-comb way through all of the relevant hadiths and said that he doesn't actually think that instrumental music is haram. Qamat al-Qiyamah, everybody starts jumping up and shouting and astaghfirullah. But insofar as you can see a kind of pattern emerging on the landscape of the ulama with their different positions, huge, ugly generalization, but maybe there's something in it. The more you move towards the kind of aql side of the fiqh spectrum, the Hanafis, the more people are inclined to prohibit. And the more you move towards the naql, or the sort of hadith-based area, the more you're going to find people who will allow it. The Zahiris, for instance, who are kind of more literalist than the Hanbalis, generally allow most instrumental music. So Ibn Hazm al-Zahiri, the most literalist of all, says, everything that isn't explicitly forbidden in the Qur'an and the Hadith is all right, and you don't have the right to do qiyas or to extrapolate in any way. And if this particular type of Spanish flute is not there in a specific Hadith and forbidden, it's not within the human powers to say that that thing is forbidden. And that's his well-known view. And some of the Malikis also, interestingly, particularly some of the rather austere original Medina Malikis, will report views from Imam Malik that he allowed certain types of stringed instruments, certain types of flutes. That's not the mashhur, the usual view in the madhab, which is hurma, forbidding, but there is that position. Mawardi also reports of some of the disciples of Imam Shafi'i that Imam Shafi'i would allow certain types of instrumental music. But if you move to the kind of aql end, sort of Maturidi rationalizing thing, the Hanafis generally produce the fewest exceptions. So there's even Kasani, for instance, has this long discussion in his Bada'i as-Sana'i, the Hanafi fiqh, about all the different kinds of instruments, which if somebody has been found listening to them, means that he can never testify in a Sharia court, for instance. So tough. That's an interesting circumstance. I don't know what we can make of it, that it's the kind of rationalizers of the fuqaha who have inclined most to the view that it's forbidden, and the literalists who tend to produce this minority that says that it's permissible. That's just an aside. There's also, of course, the reformist tendencies. So in Egypt, Mahmoud Shaltut, Sheikh al-Azhar in the 1950s, said it's fine. Sheikh Jad al-Haq in the early 1980s, when I was living in Egypt, did a more complex fatwa looking at the classical views and saying it's not a matter of consensus, it's a matter of majority hukum that instrumental music is not allowed. And essentially it depends on the maqasid. In other words, If you're playing a violin in a nightclub on Pyramid Road and there's some dancing going on, that's not really something the Sharia is going to be terribly overjoyed about. But if it's in a different context where it doesn't lead to or isn't conventionally associated with the acceptability of corrupt practices, then it's something else. So part of the rationalizing tendency in recent times has been to link it to the maqasid and to say it's really about what sort of behavior music will lead to. And you do get some odd discussions in the medieval period about certain types of pipes. They said always are associated with fasad, and therefore that's why they're haram. Well, a pipe is just a pipe. It's not necessarily the association. Yusuf Qardawi, of course, has a long fatwa in which he authorizes instrumental music. So that kind of reformist school is there as well. Other issue that is interesting is what you do with certain types of electronic music. So for instance, if the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia has a ringtone on his phone, or if he has a doorbell that goes ding dong, yeah, it's a serious issue. Is that music or not? What is the definition of music? If it's just dong, is that music? What does it have to sound like? If it sounds kind of like an electronic sound, what about a police siren? What about a fire engine? What about music in a supermarket? Where exactly is the boundary? So it's never quite clear cut. There's always areas which are confusing. And electronic music, which kind of surrounds us, every time you turn your computer on, it goes, ah, it's my new Mac computer. Astaghfirullah, it's got some kind of symphonic thing at the beginning. Maybe some people are agitated by that, but that's to make the Sharia rather a strange thing. It's not really there for entertainment, just to tell you that you press the on button. So these are also issues. And what do you do with certain types of synthesized music that sound like music that's been generated by these putatively forbidden pipes and stringed instruments and so forth? Not easy. What do you do with a human voice that is so well trained that it can sound exactly like a violin? So a lot of grey areas. But my teacher's usual preference was to err on the side of caution. And there's a wisdom in that, because what is unmistakably and unambiguously and unanimously halal is the use of the human voice. The human voice is actually the most profound and subtle and beautiful of instruments. This is part of the gift that Allah has given us, that despite the complexity of the guitar and the lute and the piano and the organ, it doesn't compete with the beauty of a great singer. This is part of the takrim, the honoring that's been given to Bani Adam. Which means that to some extent you can have the fullness of a musical experience without having to get into those fiqh controversies and things with harmonies and the fullness of the maqam system, and also the sense that the human voice is coming from the human depths, unlike the sound of a pipe or a violin or the organ at the chapel next door, which is something mechanical. There's something more human about it, and hence more humanly interesting. So that is, I think, where we are at the moment in the Ummah, even though we're at a very sort of jumpy and paranoid time where people are really hyperventilating about things which, Abul Ghani Nablusi, what was his book called? I can't remember, but it's about Sama' al-Alat, something fi Sama' al-Alat. He was this great 17th, 18th century sage of Damascus, one of the great ulama of the Ottoman Empire with hundreds of books, a very profound person, who again gives you a long explanation of why the use of musical instruments, if it's not connected to the belly dancing industry, is fine. So that does exist. Those books are there, whether it's Nablusi or Ibn Hazm, two very different life forms. That opinion is there in the Ummah. But best to stay with the uncontroversial, because the world is full of minds ready to be stepped on. And the human voice is, alhamdulillah, the best of all instruments. And we do know now, the scientists have told us, that collective singing releases those endorphins and gets us going and helps us to bond, and is a primordial and ancient human practice and a sacred practice. So that's all I wanted to say, except commercial break, we are selling some of our fine CDs and DVDs at knockdown prices only to participants in the CMC annual retreat. We have they're all Sharia compliant, fingers off the panic buttons, not a violin in sight. We have the Molid of Barazanji. We have the, you can see them being held up now by my assistant. There is the Gleams from the Raudat of Shuhada, which is mostly in English, which is a recital in Celtic harmonies of the history of the Ahlul Bayt. The Sufi Songs of Andalusia, which is flamenco and traditional Arabic and Spanish songs from the time of the Inquisition. And there's the Mawlid of Imam Barazanji, perhaps the best known of all Mawlid, recorded live in the Azawiya Mosque in Cape Town, according to some very beautiful African harmonies that they use there, and all kinds of other goodies that you can get. And every penny goes to the Cambridge New Mosque Project. So that will be after this session, inshallah, and before the namaz.